Judge Smith, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Renee Wurke presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Go ahead and take a seat. I hope sometime I'll get tired of saying it's always so nice to be back at the Judicial Center having our hearings. Welcome. We are having a calendar today that is comprised of four oral arguments and one non-oral case is also going to be submitted today, October 5, 2022. The rules of court have not changed. You each have 15 minutes to state your direct case, and 5 minutes is reserved always for appellant counsel for rebuttal purposes if you choose to utilize that. A reminder, state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your arguments. And I'll have our marshal call the first case for consideration.
Calling case number 822-0452, Moses versus State of Minnesota.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Max Keller, M-A-X-K-E-L-L-E-R, for appellant Marcel Moses. We're arguing today that the evidence was insufficient to convict Mr. Moses and that there was ineffective assistance of counsel.
May I interrupt just a moment? Is the microphone on? I'm having a little trouble hearing. Just want to make sure.
Can you hear me okay now?
Yeah, maybe get a little closer or something. Thanks.
I'm turning up the volume, but I think that volume is my volume. So I'm looking now at our marshal. You can flip
okay.
it up. Thanks.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
Thank you. So the primary issue for insufficiency of the evidence is identification. Obviously, identification is a very important issue in every case, arguably. Now,
doesn't that come down to a credibility determination? I mean, we have the young girl who testifies about a fellow with a pink shirt. She apparently knows the other individuals that are there, or at least is familiar with them. I mean, isn't this something that the jury heard and considered, and it's weighing the credibility of the different individuals testifying?
Thank you for that question, Judge Wurke. I'm tempted to say it's like being at the Supreme Court when you get a quick question. Well, you can certainly look at it that way. That's not the way we look at it, but I wanted to address what's actually in the record because this is what she said, the complainant, and so this part of it is not a credibility question. This is what she said. There's no dispute about what she said. So in Exhibit 20, on page 11, which is cited on page 8 of our brief, she said he had a tattoo on his face. That's a quote. Then she said, because on his picture, he had a tattoo on his forehead. Questioner says, okay, on his picture? She says, yeah. Question, what picture? Complainant says, his picture my auntie showed me yesterday. Question, okay, when you saw him, did you see a tattoo? I don't know. Now, that's all from the corner house interview. Now, we're going to get to what she said in the transcript before the jury, but, you know, that kind of begs the question right there, like, why is your auntie showing you a picture? And then she says, well, did you see a tattoo when you actually saw him? The questioner is basically saying, well, forget about the picture. What about the guy that you actually saw who assaulted you? Did you see a tattoo? And she says, I don't know. Then, in the transcript, there's basically ineffective assistance of counsel because the way the question gets asked is not the right way to ask the question because basically you would want to ask the question something like this is, well, you said you saw a guy with a tattoo. Now, this guy here doesn't have a tattoo, right? Yeah, so that's not the guy, right? But that's not the way the question was asked. The question is asked something like, well, why are you sure that this guy, Mr. Moses, is the guy if he doesn't have a tattoo? That's not the way that you ask the question. So there is a huge identity issue there. And when she was asked about what
Well, you're pointing to one element of the identity issue. And I understand there was some conflicting testimony as far as the tattoo on his face. But we start out with the guy with the pink shirt. And normally, if it was a large crowd, I'd say, oh, my goodness, that's not sufficient. I would agree with you, Mr. Keller, as far as where you're going. But we have a small group of men, and we have one person wearing a pink shirt, which was, in fact, testified to by more than the complainant. It was testified by Auntie. Auntie swatted him with the broom, the guy in the pink shirt. So are you asking us to pick and choose the evidence?
Well, I understand the point of what you're raising, so I appreciate that, Judge. But the pink shirt, I don't know where it came from. Sure, it's a problem for the appellant. There wasn't 100 people there, as you pointed out. There wasn't 1,000 people there. It wasn't.
Okay, so I'm not trying to cut your answer off, but you said, sure, it was a problem for him. And this is what I'm getting at. It appears that you're asking us to reweigh the evidence and these various identification things that came in. They were all heard by the jury, and the weight given by any one or two factors isn't before us. Why would we substitute a tattoo as greater evidence than a pink shirt?
Well, I understand that the appellate court is not going to reweigh the credibility determinations of the jury, but we don't necessarily look at this as falling within that box, so to speak. So in my mind, there isn't really a dispute about a tattoo. If there's a dispute about a tattoo, the only dispute is in the complainant's mind. So if she can't figure out if there was a tattoo or not, how does that make any sense? And in fact, when she made the statement at Corner House about the tattoo, that was, as we would expect, it was shortly after the incident. It was just 3 days after this incident. Then when she testifies at trial, it's 6 months afterwards. So when would her memory be better? Of course, she doesn't necessarily even remember what she said at Corner House, which is why I said it's ineffective assistance of counsel, because the trial counsel says to her basically, well, didn't you say that before when you were interviewed at Corner House, didn't you say that this guy had a tattoo? And she says, I don't know. Well, you can't just leave the
witness.
Well,
how does that stay at, how does that qualify as ineffective assistance of counsel? He did, the attorney properly cross-examined her and attempted to discredit her. Isn't that what he did?
Well, this is what I'm getting to, Judge, is the way the question was asked is he basically said, well, didn't you say before back at Corner House, when you were interviewed at Corner House, that your assailant had a tattoo? And she says, I don't know. Well, that's not the right answer. It's right here on T81 to 83. She said, I don't know. that's when she was asked if appellant was her assailant. But before that, she said, I don't know if he had a tattoo. So that's not the right answer. I don't know if I said he had a tattoo. She did say he had a tattoo. That's undisputed, basically. So I'm saying it's ineffective assistance of counsel because when you're faced with a witness like that who doesn't remember their prior statement, then you have to say, well, look, this is your prior statement right here. Do you remember this? Do you want to see it? Would this refresh your recollection? Okay, now you looked at this. Do you agree that you said it had a tattoo?
So essentially you're objecting that he didn't properly impeach her.
That's right, and it makes all the difference in the world. It's not just like, oh, someone says, oh, well, it was just a little mistake. It's not a big deal. It's not prejudicial, so on and so forth. It makes all the difference in the world because identity is a huge issue. And why is she saying there's a tattoo? Because the one thing everyone agrees on is there is no tattoo on Mr. Moses. No one's claiming there's a tattoo on Mr. Moses. So if she said that the person who did this to her had a tattoo, well, that's a huge thing. And why is her auntie showing her a picture of anyone? Either she knows who did it or she didn't. Her auntie doesn't need to show her a picture. And if her auntie shows her a picture, what's the deal? Why does this person have a tattoo? That's not Mr. Moses. So, you know, as we said, there's a fault of investigation. There's ineffective assistance of counsel with regards to investigation because that should have been investigated. Now, the court issue mentioned the issue of the pink shirt. So, of course, it's possible that maybe the assailant wasn't wearing a pink shirt, but her memory is incorrect. Now, suppose that she said there's a pink shirt, but now her identity, her identification, let's say, had been completely impeached in the manner that I just suggested.
But that would go to the weight of her testimony, whether a jury felt she was strong in her recall or whether she was weak. It would go to the weight that they would attribute to that one particular witness.
Well, one might argue that. I guess what I'm arguing is the weight of her testimony would be given a lot less weight if all she has to hang her hat on is supposedly a pink shirt, but she can't say, well, that's the guy who did it because, well, this guy doesn't have a tattoo. And she said, the guy who did this to me has a tattoo. And there's no question that she said he had a tattoo. It's not like, oh, maybe you said there was a tattoo, or maybe we don't know about that. No, we know what you said 3 days afterwards.
Well, so, one of your other claims as far as ineffective assistance of counsel is the fact that there was not a DNA expert that testified on behalf of your client. Your time is running down, so I thought we should discuss that.
Sure. So thank you. So as far as ineffective assistance of counsel, part of it has to do with inadequate investigation. As I said, part of it has to do with what you just referred to, Judge, with a DNA expert. So one thing that I wrote down to emphasize here that I wrote down this morning is that unlike what I say is most of the ineffective assistance claims by defendants, like 99% of them, they say, oh, my lawyer didn't do this, and I told him about this, and there's no way of proving that they ever told him about X. But here, it's the contrary case. We've got on transcript page 427 on line 5, the appellant said to the trial judge in the middle of the trial, I need my own DNA expert, and it's going to be ineffective assistance of counsel if I have to go ahead without my own DNA expert. And he's right in the sense that it would be a much better case for him if he had his own DNA expert.
You're not asserting or claiming that the attorney was faulty in any of his questioning of DNA or his knowledge of DNA. Is it fair to say, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, that it's the fact that he did not have an expert? Is that what is guiding that claim?
I think what we're left with at this point is that, yes, he should have gotten his own expert. There's no reason he couldn't have gotten his own expert. And Mr. Moses was right, because what happened is the trial counsel goes up there and argues, for example, in opening statement, as I read last night, that, well, there's a 1 out of 287 chance of a random match with this YSTR DNA. So it's not, of course, a case where you have very specific DNA where you say the chance of a random match is 1 in 4 billion, for example. This
so
is
So what would your purported expert have said that would have led to the jury coming to a different conclusion?
Well, that's what I was getting to, thank you, is that the trial counsel goes up there and argues, well, according to their own statistics, it's a random possibility of match of 1 in 287. But if they had their own expert that went up there and testified to that, it's much stronger. The weight given to the jury would be much stronger if that were the case. So we do think that there should have been a greater investigation. The state usually argues that investigation is just a strategic decision, basically. But as we pointed out, the case law, including Strickland, says that the adequacy of an investigation basically is based on what you know. So the U.S. Supreme Court in Strickland said, quote, that they have, quote, defined the deference owed such strategic judgments in terms of the adequacy of the investigation supporting those judgments. So if you don't investigate something, then you can't decide not to do something because you really don't have the facts to make a strategic decision that would be due some type of deference. So Strickland does not establish that a cursory investigation automatically justifies a tactical decision with respect to certain things, and the reviewing court would have to consider the reasonableness of the investigation to support that strategy. And so our position is that the trial counsel did not do an adequate investigation into the DNA evidence, should have retained their own DNA expert.
And may I ask, counsel, what is it that the defense counsel failed to learn by failing to investigate the DNA evidence?
Well, I mean, the primary thing is he was arguing things about the DNA by cross-examining the state's expert, and it would be a much stronger position if they had their own expert, because as the appellant said on that site that I gave, T427, basically, of course the state's expert is going to give their own spin on it. I see my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal purposes. Mr. Petras, you're up.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. With respect to sufficiency, there was more than enough evidence in this case to support the jury's verdict. A conviction, case law makes very clear, may sufficiently rest on the testimony of a single credible witness. And on top of that, Minnesota Statute 609.347 Subdivision 1 clearly establishes that in a prosecution for first-degree criminal sexual conduct, the testimony of that victim does not need to be corroborated. In this case, the victim was still distraught when she reported the sexual assault to her aunt within an hour of it happening. The victim identified the attacker as a man wearing a pink shirt. And it is undisputed that appellant was the only person present at the house that night who was wearing a pink shirt.
You know, I think what the defense is complaining about is that it appeared that you started, Mr. Keller started calling her auntie, so I'll stick with that, that auntie was somehow coaching the complainant in this case as it related to a tattoo and so on. So can you defend on that basis? Was there coaching of the complainant to pick out this person or single him out?
There was not. If we look specifically to Court Exhibit 20A, Court Exhibit 20A is the transcript of the corner house interview, which itself is Exhibit 20. Page 11, I urge this court to read the entirety of page 11 of that transcript, because in it, it makes clear that Auntie showed the victim a photograph before the corner house interview. In that photograph was a person who had a face tattoo. In that transcript, in the corner house interview, the victim never says that the attacker, the person who actually sexually assaulted her in her auntie's house, had a face tattoo. She says she doesn't know if he did or if he didn't. The person in the photograph, who we don't know who it is who had the face tattoo. But in the corner house interview, the victim never says her attacker had a face tattoo. This is entirely consistent with her trial testimony on pages 286 and 287 of the transcript, in which she testifies, I never said my attacker had a face tattoo, and I don't know if he had one. That addresses the tattoo issue. In addition to the coaching question, Judge Werke, this victim made consistent statements when her auntie was not present. She made it to the aunt. She also made it to the police. She also made it to the corner house interviewer, and she also made it to the jury, consistent with what happened to her inside that house. Serology testing indicated the presence of human saliva on appellant's penis, and of course, the male DNA found in the victim's mouth matched the appellant's YSTR profile. And finally, the victim identified in court on pages 264 to 265 of the trial transcript her attacker as being appellant. The evidence amply supports the jury's verdict. Briefly, with respect to ineffective assistance of counsel, the critical flaws, as Judge Redding accurately explained in her post-conviction order, is that appellant fails to identify how his trial counsel's investigation and performance was inadequate, or, as this court's questions this morning were driving at, what different or additional evidence a defense-hired DNA expert could have offered in this case.
And again, I think what Mr. Keller is getting at is it's the appearance issue to the jury. Oh, gee, the state has somebody that is an expert on DNA, and all the defendant had was his attorney. And, of course, the judge always says what the attorneys say are not evidence. They tell you that in their instructions. So it sort of looks like, well, they had somebody on their side. Why didn't the defense? So, I mean, wouldn't it appear to have been more fair if he had his own ability to present DNA testimony?
I don't think the Sixth Amendment requires a defendant to have a expert witness for that corresponds to every expert witness the state calls. I'm not aware of any case law ever establishing that principle. And more specifically, if there had been a defense expert, there's no indication anywhere in the record, either at the post-conviction proceedings or in the trial record, how the words coming out of that defense expert's mouth would have differed in any way from what the state expert said. The evidence is indisputed as terms of what the DNA testing and the serology testing determined in this case about where there was saliva, appellant's penis, and where the YSTR profile of appellant was, which was on in the swab taken from the victim's mouth. That is what distinguishes this case from, say, the Wiggins decision that appellant cites in his brief, is that appellant has essentially failed to produce any evidence showing what a different investigation or a different performance by his trial counsel could have led to in this case. And in terms of the last ineffective assistance claim that I've heard discussed today, which is about questioning about the tattoo, I would direct this court to the state's brief, specifically page 13, footnote 5, where we cite the Azure decision. If you read over Judge Redding's post-conviction order, you'll see that she never addressed an ineffective assistance claim that was premised on how the trial counsel questioned the victim about the tattoo. And that's because it was never raised below. It does not appear anywhere in the 11-page amended post-conviction petition. And because of that, Azure compels this court to find that that specific ineffective assistance claim is forfeited for failure to being raised below. With my remaining time, I am more than happy to try to address any other questions that the panel has.
May I just ask on that, and is that because, I mean, normally when we have a direct appeal and then also stayed for post-conviction, you know, you can raise the issues, obviously, on a direct
appeal. This is not a direct appeal.
But, right. I mean, it goes to a post-conviction, and then it comes back to us, and then you can raise both issues. You're saying that the ineffective assistance of counsel claim was waived in this, forfeited in this case, even though it was because the appeal was dismissed.
Yes.
It just has that quirk. Normally, otherwise, we could address on direct appeal when it's in state and gone to post-conviction, we could address all the issues, but this had the quirk of a dismissal, right?
Yes, the direct appeal was dismissed, and then it was filed initially, the proceeding that has gone up to this court was a post-conviction petition.
It was a dismissal due to the appellant's fault?
I believe this court, and I can't recall which particular judge on this court, but this court issued an order dismissing the original direct appeal because it had been stayed for over a year, and then there had been no progress in the post-conviction court in doing what the reason for that stay.
By this court. Wasn't there a deadline, either do it or finish it or not?
I believe there were several deadlines that were blown through in that original direct appeal that was dismissed. So, yes. The state, in a different footnote in its brief, takes the position that, or acknowledges that it could take the same position with respect to the sufficiency claim, because again, that was not raised below in the post-conviction petition, which again is why Judge Redding did not decide that particular issue. I did not write the state's brief in this case, but I think that the state took the position that it did, because a claim like sufficiency is based obviously solely on the trial record, whereas a claim like ineffective assistance of counsel sometimes lends itself to the additional fact development that can occur at a post-conviction proceeding, which obviously...
Sometimes it's discernible from the record itself.
Correct.
And it seems like the method of cross-examination might be discernible from the trial record.
There are multiple ways that this court can address the ineffective assistance claim premised on the tattoo issue.
Thank you, Mr. Petros. I've got your name right now. It's been so long since I've seen you. I won't make that mistake again.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Keller, you have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you. So to address the last point first, which is the backwards way that we do things a lot of times, what the state was just arguing about forfeiture of an argument, the way I understood what they were arguing in the brief is the state's not arguing that all ineffective assistance claims in this case are forfeited. What they were arguing is only the claim about an inadequate investigation by a failure to interview the auntie. So that's a point of clarification. Now, I'll just say that there's more than one way to go after that. So one way is to interview the auntie. That would be investigation. Another thing is to call her as a witness and say, well, did you show the complainant a picture? Which she obviously did, unless you believe that the complainant is a liar. Why would she lie about that? And then say, well, why did you show her a picture, and whose picture did you show her? Presumably she knows whose picture she showed her. That would be very informative. I wish we had that information. Now, the state just directed you to go back to Exhibit 20A, which I was reading to the court at the beginning, because as I said, there's no dispute about what she said at Corner House, and there's no dispute about what she said to the jury. We have it in black and white in a transcript, a transcript of the Corner House interview, and B, a trial transcript. So here's what she said. She said, quote, he had a tattoo on his face, because on his picture, he had a tattoo on his forehead. So I don't know how to read that except to say that I, the complainant, am telling you that he had a tattoo on his face because I saw it on his picture. And then the next question is, okay, on his picture? Yeah. What picture? His picture my auntie showed me yesterday. Okay, when you saw him, did you see a tattoo? And she says, I don't know. Now, maybe that's what the state means when they say, well, she never actually said that the assailant had a tattoo, but you look at her testimony, it tends to make you believe that she has no idea what the person looked like. And there was later on questions in the Corner House interview where they kind of said, well, can you tell us anything about him? Well, he was black. That's it. He was black. He was more than 18. Well, that's not very much of a description. So it sounds like she really can't describe him at all except from this picture, which doesn't really make any sense. And remember, this is an interview that happens 3 days after the incident as opposed to a trial that happened six months later. And in the trial transcript, ineffective cross-examination is this, is the trial counsel says, okay, is that because now that you're here, the person that the state has on trial doesn't have a tattoo on their forehead? And she says, I don't know. Now, I don't even know what that I don't know means, right, because of the way the question is. Then the trial counsel says, how do you know that it was Mr. Moses? Now, that's the beginning of the question. That's not how you ask the question. You don't say, how do you know it was Mr. Moses? She doesn't know it was Mr. Moses. That's the whole point. So that's why you don't ask the question that way. But the trial counsel says, how do you know it was Mr. Moses if you don't know whether he even had a tattoo on his forehead? And then she says, I don't know. Now, again, I would say, I don't even know what that I don't know means, because the question isn't really phrased in the correct manner to get the correct answer out of the witness. I would say basically that this is, amongst other things, a case of inherent implausibility, because this man supposedly goes up and does this to this girl for a couple of seconds. Why would he just go up and do this for a couple of seconds? It doesn't make any sense. And all these people are coming in and out of the house, and no one says that they walked in and saw him committing this sexual act against this child. How could that be when all these people are coming in and out at the same time? It doesn't make any sense. Now, the last thing, because I have 40 seconds left, is the court appropriately asks, well, what would the expert have produced if he got an expert? What would they have said that wasn't already said by someone else? And, yeah, it does make a difference who said it. And Judge Werke points that out. So here's what the expert would have said, basically. Besides the fact that this is YSTR DNA and it's not like a 1 in 4 billion match, also what we have is, before we even get to those numbers, we have a situation where the state's witness testified that on a bunch of different samples, the defendant or appellant's DNA wasn't even found, and one place it's found is in her mouth. So that means it could just be from sharing a cup. It would make a big difference if the appellant had his own witness to say that, yeah, this can just be from sharing a cup. It's not actually found someplace like on his penis. That makes a big difference. So we ask that you reverse the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keller and Mr. Petras. The matters are deemed submitted, which means a decision will be issued in the 90 days.